Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Arvind. We most humbly offer our loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. We are back to that fortnight where we discuss the book which was compiled by Dr. Hislop, one of Swami's ardent devotees from the United States. The book, The Conversations with Bhagwan Shri Sathya Sai Baba, where he recorded some of the beautiful interactions that he had with Swami and he was witness. We've gone through, I think, in the book, or at least in the published version on the website, I think we've covered almost four chapters of that book. The end of the fourth chapter is where we left out. There's a small bit which we left out. We'll do that part. But the next part is, of course, a completely different It starts off afresh in a different topic. It's very interesting, like the other ones. Very beautiful explanations which Swami gives. Sometimes there are different questions and parallel conversations which are happening, but Swami is giving very beautiful and relevant answers. Relevant always, but relevant to us even today in that sense. So it's going to be very interesting and very insightful to go through all of them. So before we do that, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam, Arvind.
Sairam, Prem, and as you said, we have got the last part of the first interview. Dr. Hislop has classified the book into different chapters based on the themes, but then several chapters have been covered in a single interview itself. So we are now reaching the end point of interview number one. And after that, as you said, we'll be taking over to the next interview. But as it always happens, you know, whether it is the end of Bhagwan's discourse or whether the end of Bhagwan's interview, it's almost like we come down to what we can call, in quotes, practical stuff. Even in Bhagwan's discourse, when we listen, it starts off with a beautiful poem mostly. And that poem is like the seed from which the entire discourse will sprout. It's so beautifully structured. And Swami starts with the Upanishadic or the scriptural lofty ideals and statements and starts explaining, then comes the analogies, then come stories, then come different things. And towards the final part of the discourse, it is what even as students we would look forward to, because that will be like the practical stuff, what we should do. And, you know, it's more like a conversation that we would hold among our friends. Whereas the first part would actually seem like a discourse. And many times I remember as students, we would say that, hey, today's discourse was a bouncer, man. Meaning that it went over the head, nothing went inside. But however like a bouncer a discourse might seem, the end of the discourse always would be enjoyable because Swami would always come down to what we call as practical stuff. Mundane stuff. So that's what is happening in this interview as well, because though in the initial part it is Swami giving them what he has come to give them, the ending of the interview is almost like people trying to get from Swami what they have come to receive from him. And so we can see all kinds of personal and trivial kinds of things being asked of Swami. Now before we go into that, I just thought of sharing this point that when we read it today, it will seem so trivial. But at that point in time, surely it must have been something that was on top of their head, that was bothering them the most. Otherwise, why would they want to ask that from Swami? Now, this whole experience makes me feel that when we also ask from Swami, maybe we can, you know, try to do a kind of projection. Whereas, see, what I'm asking from Swami today, 5 months from now, will I look back and think that it was trivial? 5 years from now, will it be trivial? It'll be difficult to extrapolate, say, 50 years from now. But at least 5 months, 5 years from now, if I'm able to extrapolate. And if I feel that in 5 years' time, what I'm asking now is such a trivial thing, then maybe I should reconsider what I'm trying to ask Swami. That is what I felt when I went through this last part, because many of it I felt trivial, but it is not like I'm mocking those people, because for them it must have been very important, and it reminded me of my own things that I've asked from Swami, which are so trivial actually, but at that point in time it felt like the whole of life or the end of life. So this is a message that comes to us at another level, you know, even without actually it being stated explicitly in the book.
Very true. In a sense, you know, when you're in Swami's presence, one of the many things is the conversation which happens. We give a lot of importance to that, because as you're saying, even in a discourse, the part which we can directly take away home and start using is what we directly connect to. Similarly, in that, I think when we are in Swami's presence, what we speak to Swami and what Swami speaks to us is probably the most obvious part where, you know, there's something for us to take. But there's so much more to being in Swami's presence. I recall when there was a time when Swami was asking a lot of students to write the exam, which was, it was a qualifying exam to join a PhD. Mm. We used to call that National Eligibility Test or something like that. So Swami would randomly walk in, pick up boys and say, go write the exam. So there was a time when people used to be, you know, try to hide from Swami's gaze, because you would, and even people, I think even Sai Prakash once, Swami called him and said, will you go and write? This was after 3 years of working in Radio Sai. Mm-hmm. So there was a time when Swami was doing that. So Swami sent one group of boys to Bangalore, and when they came back, Swami called them for an interview, and Swami was asking each one how they had done the exam. So one of the boys, Swami asked him, how did you do your exam? And he said, Swami, fine. And then Swami moved on to the next boy and started asking. So one of the seniors came back, and you know, he was telling me this. I think I was witness to that conversation. He was saying, see, when Swami asks you, how did you do the exam? You should not simply say, fine, Swami, I've done well. See, that is a way by which you end the conversation. You have to say something more. You have to say, Swami, I did well, but you know, the first part was very difficult. The second part was more easy, Swami, but you know, most of it, something you have to tell
To build extend
the conversation. Because, you know, that is the most important thing. You know, you could always get pearls of wisdom during a conversation. But for your end, you have to do whatever it takes to extend the conversation. Keep asking something, keep Swami engaged. Right. So I think when you go back to some of these conversations in the book, which probably is not directly related to what is being discussed, especially the philosophical topics which are being discussed, I picture it this way. You know, Swami must have completed that statement, and there must have been a small gap. You know, Swami is waiting for something to be said, or people are waiting for Swami to say something more. So then suddenly some visitor starts the conversation and says something so that Swami doesn't say, Manchidi, I point the all if you can go.
And we can also empathize ourselves doing it so many times. In fact, it would be the reverse with the students, wherein the moment Swami is trying to wrap up, you then start shooting philosophical and deeply spiritual questions. Because I remember, you know, when Swami would come into the bhajan hall to interact, as he begins interacting, everybody will start asking all the personal stuff. And then after 15-20 minutes, Swami will tell, enough, okay, let's go. Swami, what about faith? Swami, how to get develop faith? You know, just shoot one question like that. But Swami is so sweet, Swami is so loving, Swami is so compassionate that he takes that, and invariably that in itself would develop into a discourse. You know, a random doubt that is asked, possibly without much sincerity of intent, you know, just with the only intention that Swami should interact more with us, Swami should be here more with us. But I think that is enough for Swami. That is the beauty of Swami. That is enough. You want me to be with you, enough. Even if you are not genuinely interested in knowing what is fear or what is faith, I will give you that wisdom, because even if you are not receiving that wisdom, you are receiving my presence which you are yearning for. So that is Swami's sweetness, and we will see that as Swami answers this also. So continuing where we left off, there is this visitor who is asking Swami, Swami, I have been away from business and I want to talk with Swami. But if I stay another month, there will be only one final talk with Swami. I want to talk with Swami now and then stay a month. I think this is what we were discussing the last time when we were here, that Swami usually had this practice of granting an interview before somebody was leaving. Now here is this person who is saying that I'm going to be here for a month, but I don't have the patience to wait for a month for an interview. Please, if I tell you that I'm here for a month, you will give me an interview at the end of 1 month. What is my desire is I want to get an interview right away and then stay on here for 1 month. That's what he's expressing to Swami. And Swami is saying, tomorrow is Thursday Swami will see each of you individually and you can make your plans when you want to leave or stay. With you it is like this. You have a few doubts. Now you want to clear these doubts immediately. So as you leave room, so as to leave room for new doubts. And as Swami says this, everyone around smiles and laughs. That is your plan, Swami says. So Swami so sweetly speaks obligingly and even obliges. He says that tomorrow is Thursday. I will see all of you and I will clear your doubts.
Right. And going back to what you were saying about, we seeing whether these are important things, especially five years down the line. I think it goes back to one of the discussions we had about, what is important but is not urgent and what is actually unimportant, but we make it urgent because of our thinking. Sometimes, we think it's urgent.
Mm.
I think most of this philosophical content of whatever Swami is talking, it's very, very important, but it's like, Swami, it can wait. But here is this plan I have to make right away. Whether you want me to leave now or leave tomorrow, I have to go and book my tickets. So I think that is the urgency with which people ask these things. But as you said, Swami also very sweetly obliges even such questions and he speaks to them.
At such moments, I feel it helps to get back Swami's statement where he says, seek that seeking which you'll never have to seek again. Now, this opportunity to speak to Swami, whether physically or in our dream or in our meditation, whenever we get that opportunity, we should not take it lightly. We should remember there have been so many people in the past, whether it is Dhruva, Prahlada, Mirabai, sages, saints, who have yearned and done tapas for so much time in order to get that one moment of interaction with God. And I feel that though we think of tapas as standing on one foot or, holding one's breath or doing things that are very difficult for such a long period of time, that I feel is just a physical manifestation of the tapas. The actual tapas that goes on within, I think, is about arriving at that one thing. When I get the opportunity from the Kalpavriksha, from the wish-fulfilling tree, from the Kamadhenu, the wish-fulfilling cow, when I'm getting that opportunity to ask for anything that will be granted, what is it that I should ask? And I think the tapas is what goes into arriving at that. What is it that I'm going to ask from Swami when I get the opportunity? Because we need to do a lot of intellectual, emotional, psychological, spiritual, in-depth research to find out what is that one thing that is most valuable for me. Otherwise, we'll be, like Swami would say, you will end up asking coffee powder from the Kalpavriksha simply because it was on top of your mind. Therefore, I feel even when it comes to doubts, there are so many doubts which get cleared with just patiently being silent and observing, possibly for some time. Some doubts will just get cleared by reading into some books. So therefore, when I get an opportunity to ask from Swami, can I zero in on that one doubt, clearing which all other doubts get cleared? This statement, I have just modified it from what Swami says, seek that one thing, seeking which you don't have to seek again. And think, can I ask that one doubt, clearing which all doubts get cleared? I think, like, I remember you said this analogy of when I want water and I'm waiting for the rain, it doesn't make sense that I simply wait. In the meanwhile, it's better that if I start digging ponds and digging wells, so that when the actual rain comes, I can make maximum use of that rain that is falling. Instead of allowing the water to simply flow away into the drains, I can capture that and keep for future use. In the same way, instead of crying that Swami is not coming in my dream, Swami is not replying to me, Swami is not answering me, Swami is not giving me an interview, I think we should start preparing for when that moment comes, what is it that I will do? I think that is what is meant by tapas of all these great people. They were all just preparing for that one moment when that revelation happens. So they are perfectly ready for that moment. All the thing that happens is preparation for it. Just like an Olympic 100 meter dash athlete prepares all his life for just 10 seconds. I think we should also prepare for that moment when if Swami were to appear and say, what is it that you want? Am I ready with an answer? What is it that's bothering you, my child? I'll answer you. Am I ready with my doubt? So much of sadhana has to go in to come up ready with that doubt or with that seeking that I do. I think that is what we should do. And that is why I think Swami jocularly says that you are asking your doubts, all these doubts are just top of your mind doubts. Because the moment I clear them now, as you walk out, you will come back tomorrow with fresh doubts. There's no end to that. That's why we should come up with that one doubt, clearing which it will be the end of all doubts.
It's very interesting, you know, especially because you mentioned tapas. The many, many discourses, whenever Swami speaks about tapas, there's one thing which Swami will say. Hmm. Swami defines tapas by saying this. Tapas is nothing but unity of thought, word and deed.
Mm-hmm.
The achievement of unity of thought, word and deed is tapas, Swami would say. So if you look at it that way, it is like, you know, when you go in front of Swami, you're asking Swami for an explanation. So let's say something as generic as, Swami, what is the purpose of life? Or Swami say, what is the purpose of my life? What am I supposed to do? Any of this, Swami would say that when you ask Swami that, if you have perfect unity of thought, word and deed, you are suggesting that what will be told will be taken up as your very life.
Hmm.
Suppose Swami says you have to do seva, then if you have achieved the thought, word and deed, what Swami says will become, you know, part of your thought, words and actions. There will not be any hesitation in making it a part of your life. And Swami would often give the example of King Janaka, right, where he asked this question that, can anybody give me self-realization in the period it takes for me to put my leg over the saddle of a horse and mount it?
Hmm.
Right? He says, I climb over a horse. The time it takes to put your leg over the saddle and mount on a horse, can somebody give self-realization? And he sends word in the kingdom. He says, is there anybody like that? So finally, I think it's Ashtavakra who comes. Ashtavakra or Yajnavalka? I'm sorry.
Yajnavalka. Huh.
I don't know who is the guru who comes at that point. And he comes and says that I can do that. And he says, but there's only one condition. And he tells Janaka, you give me your mind.
Hmm.
And Janaka says, all right, I surrender my mind to you. And then Yajnavalkya takes him and he makes him sit in the middle of a forest and he says, you sit here quietly till I come back, right? And Janaka sits there and I think for hours together he doesn't move out of there. Then the ministers come, the kings, the army men come and nobody is able to wake up Janaka from there. They call out to him, they call out his name and he doesn't even stir from there. Finally they go back to the palace and they get the queen. And even when she comes, she is not able to wake up Janaka. Eventually, they go around, they catch Yajnavalkya and they say that you have done something to our king. They bring him to the presence. And then Yajnavalkya is very calm. He looks at Janaka and says, okay, Janaka, open your eyes now. And then Janaka opens his eyes. And then when they ask him, what happened? Why were you silent? Why were you not responding to our call? He says, because I have given my mind to the guru. And for doing anything, I need the mind and without the guru's permission, I cannot do it.
Wow.
So at that moment, Yajnavalkya says, okay, I'll give it to you now. I'll give you the realization now. So, if we were to make a commitment like that to Swami, will we be able to follow it? I think that is the tapas, that preparedness to do what the Guru tells you to do in completeness, in entirety. I think that's what is tapas. And as you said, you need that kind of tapas to be able to ask the right question, ask the right doubt, and that answering, the answer that you get for that one doubt is enough to satisfy all your doubts and questions.
And actually that one answer is enough to guide our entire life. You know, I'm reminded of I forget his name, from Africa, the Endola school.
Victor Kanu.
Dr. Victor Kanu. I mean, he was having such a flourishing profession and he was doing very well. And he comes and asks Swami, Swami, what is it that you want me to do? I think Swami was able to definitely see that this is a devotee who is ready, who is asking in all sincerity and he is waiting and he is going to cherish and treasure whatever Swami is going to say. Swami gives him a directive and tells, go to Africa and start a school. Now, where is London? Where is Africa? And he has no experience. Though he's of African origin, he has no experience running a school. He doesn't know what to do. Nothing he knows. And most importantly, he has no funds. He doesn't have money to do that. And he asks Swami, Swami, where do I get the money to do it? Again, this is a question that Swami is able to see that he's asking in all sincerity. So Swami says, simple, just sell your house, property, everything and go use that. And it's almost like a moment of enlightenment for Victor Kanu. He truly becomes a victor in that sense because he's able to, in thought, word and deed, accept and celebrate what Swami is telling because he does exactly that.
Actually, he says, you know, there is a anecdote in the Bible where a rich man comes to Jesus and asks, I think he asks for redemption or peace. I don't know what exactly is the prayer. So Jesus tells him, sell all your house and property and come after me. So when Swami says, sell your house and go start the school, he remembers that anecdote from the Bible.
Because he's a staunch Christian.
Right, he's a very, you know,
practicing
Christian. And he says that in that anecdote, the rich man runs away from Jesus. So he says, here is my opportunity not to do that. And he says that, and as you were saying, that it made him so happy that Swami was telling him to do that.
And finally, we know what he has done. I mean, that school was recognized as one of the most ideal and perfect schools, and it's called the Miracle School of Zambia, is it?
Right.
Yes. So that is what happens, you know. It automatically happens. But then do we have the courage, the guts, and as you said, the unity of thought, word, and deed? When I'm saying, is it a prashna or a pariprashna? When I'm asking Swami, Swami, how do I get faith? Pariprashna, as Swami would define, is something that is literally, you know, killing me. If I don't get an answer for that, I don't feel like eating, I don't feel like sleeping, it's been bothering me, it's harassing me, it is haunting me. When I ask that from Swami, that is pariprashna. Rest of it is idle questioning. Simply, as I said, we would do so that we can extend our physical intimacy with Him. So, that is about tapas and preparation. And one Swami says that, Swami tells the other visitor, you had some plan for the poor people, what are the details? And then the visitor says, Swami, the old mandir, we should make a number of new homes for the poor people. Then, those who are now staying in the old mandir can move to the new houses, and then the old temple can be made like new. It is Swami's first mandir, and it should be saved for history. If people continue to live there, it will tumble down in no time at all. To just use it for living looks like lack of respect from the people who are in Puttaparthi. And for that, Swami says, this can be discussed further at a later time. And that's how Swami stops. But you know, just going through this makes it so clear that many times this is what happens with Swami, that just because He walks with us, talks to us and lives like one among us, we get deluded in Maya and think that He is like that. And I did not know that there were people using the Upata Mandiram like how one would use a railway platform in India, just like, you know, just come and put and start staying there. So this visitor is saying that, Swami, because he's an overseas visitor, he's telling, I'll get together a group of people, we'll get the funds, and we'll build a separate accommodation, let all the homeless people live there, let not the sanctity of the old mandir be destroyed.
I don't know if it's the homeless people as such, because earlier, I think, in the 60s, devotees, there were only East Prashanti in Prashanti Nilayam, and most of them were taken by permanent residents.
Okay.
There were only about 3 or 4 rooms which Swami would give out to devotees.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the devotees used to stay in the old mandir, have their bath and everything there, and then come and attend the sessions in Prashanti Nilayam.
Oh, okay. So it's not the homeless people, it's everybody.
It's actually all devotees used to stay there in the Pathamandiram those days.
Okay.
So I think he's talking about constructing more quarters inside the Prashanti Nilayam ashram, so people don't have to stay in the old mandir, and old mandir could be renovated.
So Swami goes on to show what is it that is concerning him. He says this can be discussed further at a later date. Now Swami is troubled that all of you have come from so far spending so much. Your love is so touching. There is no price for that love, even if measured in crores and crores. Swami wants your happiness. Swami will teach as quickly as may be. So, Swami's concern is only about the devotee's progress and happiness. And we have seen this kind of, you know, Swami doesn't, in quotes, care about his legacy, his history or anything like that. Because we have seen Him replace buildings, break down that tree, you know, that tree in Vrindavan which all the older generation devotees hold so dear to their heart. Almost ruthlessly, with the least attachment, Swami got it chopped down to make way for another hall to be built for the devotees to be accommodated. So, one thing that becomes clear is Swami is the least attached to things that are associated with His physical frame or His physical sojourn on earth. If we are attached to it, I think it becomes our responsibility to preserve what we consider as His legacy.
And absolutely, even when it came to, I think, Swami's own birthplace, even that they were like, Swami, let's preserve it, you know, and the house is crumbling and all that, because it was a very, very rudimentary structure then. And Swami was like, no, take it down and let's, you know, the Shiva temple came there. I don't know which birthday it was, one of Swami's important birthdays. That was when the temple was consecrated then. So in that sense, from Swami's point of view, I think he's not bothered about any of these things. And in a sense, I think in some context, Swami had told this, that when it comes to the Indian way of looking at some of these things. You know, there's a certain way in which the modern way we look at it, where we think of history as very important and we think of history has to be preserved. And that's how we learn the progress of mankind. I think in an interview or something, Swami had mentioned this, that according to the Indian way of looking at the world, time was always given very less importance compared to in the modern context. Mm-hmm. Because time was cyclical. Because you always think of things coming again and again, the Dwapara Yuga,
the four yugas
repeating,
yes,
itself. So Swami would say that, you know, there's no concept of history, and, you know, even the civilization, if you see Indian civilization, I was reading somewhere that when they were building the metro in
Delhi,
Gurugram now?
Yes, right? Near Delhi, and near the capital city.
Apparently they found that some of the stones they were using to build were actually a few thousand years old, and it was part of ancient civilizations.
Hmm.
It's because we are living civilizations over the other civilizations in the past. It's like a continuum. There's never like, you know, that's one section of history and now the second section starts. So in that sense, I think even from Swami's point of view, it's like that he does not give much importance to this. But if we value it, we should ensure that we preserve it and pass it on, just like how we are talking about nature, preserving nature for our future generation. I think even Swami's legacy should be important for us, because we have valued it, we should be able to pass it on to the future generations.
You know, some of the places that I had visited, mm-hmm, you know, I remember them pointing out to some sites and saying, this is historical, this is 150 years old, this is 200 years old. And when they were saying that, I was just thinking, historical, 200 years old? You know, near Puttaparthi, for example, there's this place called Lepakshi, which is like 550 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many sites in India which are like 2000 years old, you know, 1500 years old, 5000 years old also, you know. So, for me, I just felt like, first of all, let me confess that I was amazed at the way they are preserving that. It's great. It's amazing. It's so much that we have to learn from them as to how they preserve. But then I felt, how can this be history? It's just 200 years. Like 200 years is my great-grandfather's time, you know.
Mm.
Now I'm just thinking that if I am feeling like this, because in my country I have spots which are 2000 years old, what to speak of Swami, who is timeless, you know. For him, when you say it is history because it is 100 years old, 500 years old, 600, everything must seem like nothing, you know. What is time for the timeless one? That is one point that came in mind. The other thing that came in mind is a dream that I had sometime before, you know. There were many of these manuscripts that were discovered inside Purnachandra Auditorium, and they said that this is what Swami has left behind. And those papers, you know, we were very eager that they should get into the archive, and it went on, this process, and who will be taking care of it, what will happen, and still, you know, it's still in a limbo, it has not yet got into the archive. So I got very worried about what will happen, you know. All said and done, you can decide what has to be done with it later, but the first priority should be moving those sheets into the archive where it's preserved. But that is not happening, it has still not happened, and it began to bother me, eat into me. That is when I had this dream, you know. In the dream, I'm seeing Swami seated amidst a sea of papers. And I'm able to perceive that these are all those important archival papers. And Swami picks up one of those documents and shows it to me. And I see that the lettering is fading away and the paper is slightly crumply. And I'm feeling very bad that, oh my God, we have neglected the legacy that Swami has left behind for us. What will happen? And at that point in time, Swami tells me, I will show you how to preserve this perfectly. And I got very thrilled, because I thought, who else to get it from than Swami himself? And then to my shock, Swami began to crumple that piece of paper. It's already brittle and it's collapsing under his hand as he's crumpling it. And then he put it in his mouth and he began to chew it. And I was shocked, because I was thinking, Swami, you are showing me the perfect way to destroy the document, not preserve it. And then Swami swallows it, and then Swami tells that you have to chew and digest it. That is the only way to preserve the legacy, you know. And when I woke up, it is, you know, it's so obvious. You don't need to be some wise man to decipher what Swami is saying. Swami says that my legacy is you. You are all my legacy. Those who follow the teachings, you don't preserve Swami's legacy by keeping some buildings intact by preserving all the papers and letters that he wrote in one museum. Even if those papers get destroyed, no problem. What is left of the Krishna avatar? Nothing. We don't have Krishna's clothes. We don't have, you know, even the Bhagavad Gita, what we get is not some manuscript which Krishna wrote. Nothing is there. But Krishna's legacy is not that. It is what the devotees are following of his teachings. And so this, you know, it just struck me. So this is possibly the reason why Swami did not care much at all about all these things that we consider as legacy. Because for Swami, those who follow his teachings, his disciples, his devotees, his dear ones, his students, they are the legacy. And that is why he gave up his life also for this, not for buildings and structures or things in concrete.
And that's why I think it becomes a dual responsibility for us, as you said. One is physically preserve it, because that's one way it has to be preserved, right? And hoping that even if we are not able to absorb it the way Swami showed it, right, digest it, at least we have physically preserved it for a future generation which will be smart enough to come and digest that legacy the way Swami had told it. So at least, if not, then we should do both. But if not that, at least the physical legacy is something we have to preserve, because Swami is not interested in that as such. Going back to this conversation, probably the last part, as we were saying that, you know, that this is an opportunity for everyone to ask Swami for whatever, you know, clarity they want. There's another visitor who says, after Swami was saying about that part where he's concerned only about people coming from so far, this visitor actually goes back to the same thing. He says, Swami, but now is the time, because there is a world conference in May and Swami's devotees will come here, and it does not matter whose plan it is to save the old mandir. It should be as though it is everyone's idea and all should work together to accomplish it. And then Swami says, you draw up a plan and show it to Swami how to do it. Before we move forward, I think this is one trick with Swami which would always work, even when we were students, right? If you tell Swami that, Swami, I want to do this, Swami, I want this, you will sense that there's a little bit of hesitation in Swami. Not hesitation, Swami will say, it's okay, we'll see later. But if you say, Swami, all of us want to do it, or all of us wish to give this to Swami, and then Swami will say, okay, then fine. And this would happen so many times. I think even the boys used to go to Kodaikanal, Swami would give them money to go do some shopping. There'll be a couple of boys will buy something for Swami and come. So they would have bought for Swami from the money Swami had given them, right? But when they present it to Swami, they'll say, Swami, this is from all of us. Because the chances of Swami taking it then is more than you saying, Swami, I bought it for you, right? And typically in that manner, this devotee is saying that, Swami, it doesn't matter who's doing it. We all want to offer it to Swami. And then Swami says, all right, you draw up a plan, then we'll think about it.
It's like, you know, somebody was mentioning how Swami would say that if a person comes and tells that he has done Gram Seva in 10 villages, Swami will be happy. But if 10 people come and tell that together they did Gram Seva in one village, Swami will be more happy. Because I feel at a fundamental level, you know, unity amongst our own selves takes us one step closer towards the ultimate that Swami wants us all to realize, which is oneness with the whole creation. If we are not able to be united even among ourselves, where is that going to happen where we will find oneness in the whole creation? And that's why possibly this is the reason why Swami would encourage and Swami would be happy to accept if the proposal comes unanimously from everyone, because that takes us one step closer towards the ultimate goal. Otherwise, whether I give it as an individual or as a group, Swami has no need of what we are giving him. But because of the feelings behind, that feeling of unity that comes behind, as Swami says, unity leads to purity, purity leads to divinity. I mean, was it purity leads to unity, unity leads to divinity. So, because it's one of those stages or steps towards the ultimate goal, Swami would encourage that.
Right. And then another visitor takes up a different question altogether. He says, and one other thing I must ask Swami, because people say Swami must be asked. I want a little plot of land on the opposite hill if I have a little place, and then put up a big shed for which I have the plan, so that there is a big place where they can come and gather and do yoga or whatever it is. But then when I am so close, and that is closer than from here to the old mandir, but not just outside the gate, so that people will be saying this or that about me, then I am outside and then you know. I don't know what exactly this person is asking. I think the idea is he wants to stay with Swami close by, but clearly he has a plans of doing something which probably is not something which Swami has started. Like he's saying that he would like to do some, yoga classes or something like that. So he's asking Swami whether he can have it outside so that it's not very far away from Swami. At the same time, it's far enough so that people don't question him as to how you can do these things in Swami's ashram.
Correct. And that's what a visitor is also saying. He's saying, visitor says, so that no control and,
Nobody oppresses you.
Yeah. And Swami says, a faithless garden. Everybody laughs. And I don't know what context Swami is saying, a faithless garden. But I just felt that the very fact that somebody feels a need to do something separately from what Swami is saying, at the same time, be associated with Swami, at the same time, be dissociated enough, associated enough. All this looks like more like your own concepts of what is good for you, which shows a lack of faith that Swami knows what is good for me. Because I feel this is good for me. Swami, I want the association with you, because without that association, possibly nobody will come here. At the same time, I want enough dissociation so that none of your volunteers come and tell me, you can't do this, stop this, and, bind me by the rules that are there. And Swami just plays it off by saying, a faithless garden. Mm-hmm. And he tries to, he goes on to the defensive. He says, well, nobody can come and say no cooking and so on, Swami. That's what he's like trying to tell, that I'm solving practical problems. But Swami then says that you are thinking these are practical problems. It might be all right to start, but then you will have so many more problems than you wish for. All the dogs from the villages, all the dogs, the villagers, and other problems. Then the visitor says, the thing is, I have said at home that I would like to have a little house outside the compound. Now slowly the origins of his desires are coming out. And Swami says, but with all the dogs together, you're going to have a great problem. 10 puppies each. Then Swami says, we will discuss it. You may start enthusiastically, but then problems that will be coming in the future will not be good. That's what Swami gives as a general warning.
Right. But I think it's a very important point that we need to keep in mind. A lot of us might tend to do this, and I think a lot of people have tried this. When you come to Swami, I think what we should always keep in mind, that we are coming as beneficiaries of what Swami has set up, right? And we should be able to come here, play along and benefit from it and go. A lot of people, it would happen that they come with their own ideas, and typically, like he's saying, you want the association with Swami, you want to associate with Swami's name and capitalize on in the structure which Swami has built, but you have your own idea which you want to seed and you want to
propagate,
see it grow,
that.
Right?
Mm.
And many times Swami would point out this, and as so beautifully Swami is doing it here, he doesn't shoot it down. Swami must be knowing the whole sequence of thinking which is going behind it, but then he breaks it down and he says, brings it down to very practical problems. And, when you're doing something which you feel that, see, this is what Swami wants me to do, and this is furthering Swami's mission, I think if dogs and villagers and all these people come, you will not mind it. But if it is coming out of your own making, I want to do this, at some point, all of these small problems also can pull you down. So that is why I think it's always better to look at what does Swami want when you're especially associating it to Swami's organization, the Sai Center or the Samiti. It is better to go back to seeing that, is it part of Swami's original plan? Would Swami approve of this? And then take it up, rather than saying that, I feel this is a good idea and this is a good platform to launch it. The Sai organization, a good platform to launch it.
And we have a classic case, close by here is the Mudenhalli, the mayhem that has started. It's all based on this, because I want to capitalize on what Swami has built, but I have my own agenda and I have one dream that I have to fulfill, and I feel that this is what Swami likes. Based on that, your unfulfilled ambition, your own unfulfilled void, you try to capitalize Swami's name and Swami's structure, Swami's superstructure, and build on that. And now this is just the glaring example close by that we are giving, but many such things happen. And that is why we have to be very wary of all these things happening, and we should be careful so that, Swami has built this for our benefit. We should come and try to align our own interests and desires with what is Swami's, and not try to shape the entire superstructure that Swami has built based on our desires and what we want.
Right. So
when Swami says that here also that all these problems will come in the future, it is not good. I was reminded of a tale from, I don't know if it's the Bhagavatam or the Hitopadesha. There's a story of how a person decides that he has had enough of family life. He wants to give it all up and become a sannyasi. And he does that. He gives up the whole family and he goes somewhere in the Himalayas or somewhere and he starts living by himself. But then he starts facing a peculiar problem. He sees that there are rats in his little hermit, whatever hermitage or hut, and they're eating away his grains and flour that he is keeping. And this is bothering him a lot, so he decides to get a cat. He keeps a cat at his home to ensure that the rats are scared away. So the day the rats come, the cat makes a meal out of them. But when the rats don't come, the cat is hungry. So now he has to feed the cat, because of which he gets a cow. You know, he starts milking the cow so that he can feed the cat. But now the cow has to be fed. And for that he has to go to a village to procure the grass. So he decides to grow the grass and all the crops that he needs at his own place. Now, he's not getting time to meditate because he has to tend to his grass and crops and everything to feed the cow. That's why he hires a gardener. But then he starts suspecting that the gardener who is working when he's meditating, possibly he's stealing some of the flour, the grains and everything. So he decides that he needs somebody to take care of everything when he can meditate. So the story goes that he goes back and gets his wife and children to stay with him now. So a samsari who decides to become a sannyasi ends up remaining a samsari, because whether it is sannyasa or samsara, it is not about what you are actually doing physically, but it's about a state of mind and what your attitude is. So I think it's almost like that Swami saying, you have given up everything and come to Prashanti, but now you want to come and start the same thing over here. You know. So what is the thing? Only in the name of Sai, or the only difference is in the name of Sai you are doing samsara, that's all. So Swami is trying to tell that why you want to get in, you have left, you have managed that tough thing. You have been able to take that step. Don't get back into it in the name of Sai. I feel that is what Swami is trying to tell, and that is very, very sound advice for all of us as well, who feel that we have given up everything for Swami, but then come and make the organization, the trust or whatever, wherever we are working, we create an entire samsara over there.
Absolutely. In fact, we were making a reference to this kind of attitude when you're doing the Bhagavatam Satsang, where Yudhishthira puts forth the idea that he wants to do this, Ashwamedha Yaga, and he says not one but two, because I've killed so many kings and princes and all that.
So not he, two but three, yes, multiple. Yeah,
multiple, he keeps saying. And then Krishna comes and tells him that it's not required, right? Because he says that I commanded and you did. I think that's some sort of explanation he gives. And immediately Yudhishthira says, no, I'm not attached to the idea. If you say that it's not required, then it's not required. Hmm. And then Krishna says that no, now since you're not attached to it, it's all right, you can do it. Hmm. And I will help you procure whatever you need, the gold and all of that.
Correct.
Right? So I think that is the most important thing, where you come to Swami with a plan. It's not like you need that plan to grow spiritually. It's like it's a plan. Okay, you have to keep yourself busy with something. Hmm. You have to keep your mind busy planning something. So you present it to Swami. The moment Swami shoots it down, I think you just, okay, this is not required. This is not required for me. This is not required for the people around. I think if we are able to approach Swami with that attitude.
With that detachment.
Right. And then if it is, even that could be beneficial. Even if it's not beneficial on its own, Swami might say, all right, you can do it and benefit from it.
At this point in time, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break and continue this interview, the last part of the interview. We thought that we'll be actually flying through this part, because there is nothing in quotes spiritual that is being imparted directly by Swami. But that is what Swami does. He inspires thoughts. He inspires so many things that there's nothing like mundane in anything that he speaks. And indeed, blessed are we that we are able to experience that in that so-called mundane things also, Swami is able to shower so much wisdom and knowledge, and we are grateful to Swami for the same. So we'll take a quick little break and continue and hopefully conclude at least the first part of the interview in today's satsang.
Sorry. charanam baba charanam charanam sai charanam ganga yamuna sangama samanam ee kshetramaina teerthamaina sai maa paandurangalu karunamayudu sai ee kshetramaina teerthamaina sai maa paandurangalu karunamayudu sai sai charanam baba charanam charanam sai charanam ganga yamuna sangama samanam అగుపించాడు విశ్వేశ్వరుడై పిల్ల పాపలా కోరిన వారికి కరుణించాడు సర్వేశ్వరుడై తినగలి చక్రం తెప్పి వ్యాధిని అరికట్టాడు విష్ణురూపుడై మహాశాశాభకు మారుతిగాలు మరికొందరికి దత్తాత్రేయుడుగా యద్భావం తద్భవతని దర్శనమిచ్చాడు ధన్యుల చేశాడు సాయి చరణం బాబా చరణ చరణం సాయి చరణం గంగా యమున సంగమ సమానం ఏ క్షేత్రమైన తీర్థమైన సాయి మా పాండురంగడు కరుణామయుడు సాయి తుఫాను తాకిదిలో అలమటించు తీరులను ఆదరించే తారణానాదుడై అజ్ఞానం బలము కొన్న అంధులను చేరదీసి అసలు చూపు ఇచ్చినాడు వైద్యుడై వీధి వీధి భిక్షమెత్తి వారి వారి పాపములను పుచ్చుకొని మోక్షమిచ్చే పూజుడై పుచ్చుకున్న పాపములను ప్రక్షాళన చేసుకునేను దౌతిక్రియే సిద్ధితో సిద్ధుడై అంగములను వేరు చేసి కండయోగ సాధనలో ఆత్మశక్తి చాటినాడు సిద్ధుడై జీవరాశులన్నిటికీ సాయే శరణం సాయే శరణం దివ్య జ్ఞాన సాధనకు సాయే శరణం సాయే శరణం ఆస్తికులకు సాయే శరణం నాస్తికులకు సాయే శరణం ఆస్తికులకు సాయే శరణం నాస్తికులకు సాయే శరణం సాయి చరణం బాబా శరణం శరణం సాయి చరణం గంగా యమున సంగమ సమానం ఈ క్షేత్రమైన తీర్థమైన సాయి ఆ పాండురంగడు కరుణామయుడు సాయి ఈ క్షేత్రమైన తీర్థమైన సాయి ఆ పాండురంగడు కరుణామయుడు సాయి ఈ క్షేత్రమైన తీర్థమైన సాయి ఆ పాండురంగడు కరుణామయుడు సాయి ఈ క్షేత్రమైన తీర్థమైన సాయి ఆ పాండురంగడు కరుణామయుడు సాయి.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were in the last part of that chapter where we said that the devotees there are asking questions, asking doubts, getting them clarified. And the last thing which we spoke about was about this devotee who is asking Swami for permission to build a quarters for himself just outside the ashram. And Swami was talking about how that could lead to more problems. And then Swami materializes a huge sugar candy, I think. A huge chunk of sugar candy distributes it to whoever is there. And then Swami says, complete sugar. And one of the visitors says, not only sugar, Swami, it is flavored. And then Swami responds to that, every day should be sweet like this, that Swami would again make the sugar. Then the visitor says, someone told me that I should not let anybody touch these earrings that you gave me because they are sacred. But I don't like to tell people not to touch. Mm-hmm. I think it's completely different.
Lady, maybe Swami had metal earrings for her.
Right. And then Swami says, nothing like that about touching. Was everyone angry because Swami did not come this morning? I don't know, maybe Swami didn't go for darshan early or whatever it is. Then the visitor says, no, Baba, we are singing bhajans and talking about the gopis. And Swami responds to that saying that gopi means sense control. One who has controlled the senses. It is not a lady's name. It's a very beautiful end to that chapter.
Exactly, because you know, when you say gopi, you think of the ladies and Vrindavan. And when Swami says that gopi is one who have got absolute sense control. Again, you know, you can go so deep into that.
Right.
I am currently in that mood because, you know, Krishnashtami is coming and I was sifting through multiple discourses of Bhagwan to, you know, pick a discourse for the Kulwant Hall to be played.
Mm-hmm.
So in one of the discourses, I was reading about how Swami is saying about how stupid and foolish people are to ascribe dirty thoughts and different feelings to the relationship between gopis and Krishna. You know, he is saying that when Krishna left Repalle, Swami is saying, he was just 7 years old. And a 7 years old does not have these kind of thoughts. If you are associating erotic thoughts there, it just shows what kind of mentality you are in. Because Swami says, just remember Krishna is just a 7 years old boy. But Swami says, this is definitely a very, very deep love, because this is a love that exists between the individual soul and the Paramatma. So that's, in that sense, it is much, much more intense and intimate, but not the kind of intense and intimate that is coming up in your fantasy and your mind. And here when Swami is saying gopi means sense control, it gives an added dimension to what Swami had said there in the discourse, because what you are thinking is so much under the level of the senses. And Swami is telling, by definition itself, gopi means one who has got absolute sense control. And I think even Krishna is given the name Rishikesha because he is the one who has absolute sense control.
Mm-hmm.
So when we speak of Krishna and gopis, it is, we are talking about beings who have absolute sense control. So therefore, Swami is saying that we look at them in that demeaning manner because of what we have. We lack sense control, and possibly that's why we see that. And I think maybe that's why Swami just gives it as a reminder also again. When you're talking about gopis, remember gopi means sense control. You can't describe anything that the gopikas have done if you lack sense control, or you're at a level that is below that of the senses.
Right. So that's how that chapter ends and that interview ends. So we'll go to the next one, because it starts off with a completely different discussion on a very new and different beautiful topic. It starts with Hislop asking this question. What does surrender to the Lord mean in such common things as shaving, going to the market, walking and so on? As we can see, I think the first or second chapter was about surrender, right? Swami makes a mention about surrender, and then Swami says it is not the English word surrender, and there you submit. And, you know, one oppresses the other. That's not what happens in the spiritual Sharanagati, because here Sharanagati is freedom. So Hislop is asking a very beautiful question of what does surrender do, or what does it mean when you're considering things like the mundane things that you do, shaving and taking care of your body and grooming your body. So Swami gives this very beautiful answer. So I'll just read it out and then we can discuss about it. Swami says, surrendering to the Lord is surrendering all thoughts and actions, not wishing for the fruits of the action, not doing action to gain its fruit, but doing the action because it's one's duty. The act is dedicated to the Lord, and the results, therefore, are borne by the Lord. Actions done thus, fruits abandoned at the time of the action, such action is free of karma. Since the ego in this way is not fed and cultivated, it disappears before long. For example, if one shaves, which is classed as an uninspired mundane task, the attitude is that one is preparing for the sake of the Lord in the heart, and one is making the best of his appearance to honor the Lord, and not for one's personal vanity or reward. Also, in walking, offer the action to the Lord to maintain a body fit for the Lord to live in. And that is the attitude for every single act of the day. Sweeping the house is dedicated to the Lord so that he may have a fit dwelling. And cooking also is dedicated to the Lord so that the body may be strong and vigorous for the benefit of the Lord.
When we look at Swami's answer, it is a straightforward and direct explanation to how we can make work into worship. There is no need of a separate worship that you have to do. We have to convert work into worship, and Swami tells also, I don't think we need to explain anything here, because it's so evident that what is most important when we do work is that awareness that we are doing it for Swami, we are doing it for Swami always. I'm reminded of an analogy that T.G. Krishnamurthy sir, who was formerly the state president of Tamil Nadu, he would give. He would say that, when you have a chauffeur for you, a chauffeur who drives your car, you are the master, the chauffeur is in your employment. The way he behaves when you are seated in the car, when the master is seated in the car, versus the way he behaves when the master is not there, are so different. When the master is not sitting in the car, Krishnamurthy sir would show that, he'll open up his stop button and say, he'll open his button, he will just sit, his hair will be disheveled, he'll just relax on the steering wheel, he'll possibly, keep whistling some tune and, put some music, nothing, and he'll just be there with gay abandon, not bothering about anything. But the moment the master comes into the car, he'll tighten up, he'll sit erect, the seat will be straightened, he will follow all the rules while driving, he'll put on the indicator, he doesn't want to, flout any rule, and he will be neatly dressed, he'll put on his hat, he'll put on his cap, and there'll be no whistling and no casual acts going on, he'll be all attention and he will be the perfect driver. So, it is the same driver, but the difference is whether the master is there or not. So too is whether we make Swami a part of our everyday action, whether we feel his presence and we are aware of his presence every moment or not. Just being aware of his presence makes us do everything in a different manner, and that is what Swami is saying here. Work itself will become worship then. So it is so important that if we think we are surrendered to Swami, we are truly surrendered to Swami, it's so important that we have to be aware of him in everything that we do in our life. That will ensure that our work gets elevated to the level of worship.
Very, very beautiful point that Swami is making, especially because, when you talk about grooming, we know that Swami himself has a lot of preferences when it comes to how we dress and how we have an appearance of our own.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about surrender in some of these attitudes, Swami is so beautifully saying that when you're grooming yourself, can you think that you're preparing yourself for Swami? And this is something that Swami would say so often, that he would say that there'll be a lot of people when they come to Mandir for Darshan, they would come very simply dressed. Right? Mm. And Swami would say, see, this is not your general practice. It's not like you're always simple. When you're back home, you wear nice makeup and you dress really well, expensive clothes and all that. And when you come here, you're trying to be simple, right? But Swami would say that if you are constantly thinking that you are having a tryst with God, you're coming to meet Swami, you're coming
how will
to
you
meet
prepare
the
for it?
The emperor of the universe. Swami would say this, if you're going to meet the queen of your country, if you're going to meet the royalty of your land, how will you go dressed? Here is the king of all kings, he is king of the universe. How much more you should think of when you're grooming yourself, am I presentable to Swami? So in that sense, everything, there's a lot of fashion trends we might follow. We might grow a beard, we might grow long hair, we might dress in all kinds of ways. All of that has a purpose, even if it's, if it's a trend, because you want to fit into the society, you want to do something which is acceptable for everybody else. But Swami is giving an opportunity to attach such a more noble and beautiful purpose to the way you groom yourself. You groom yourself in a manner and say, this Swami likes. That is so much more valuable than saying that this the world likes. This the world agrees. right? But still we are so interested to please the world and appear like suitable fits in the world, rather than saying that this is what Swami likes and I'll dress up and behave like this, right? That's an opportunity which Swami is having. And you know, sometimes if you look at it, this is a very important thing, because when you talk of surrender is a very abstract and abstruse concept. You know, living without having your eye on the fruits of the action is something which is very abstract. But Swami is saying that there are so many things which you can do and say that I'm doing this for Swami's sake, nothing more than that. This will please Swami. These are ways by which you can physically express surrender. And when we don't do that, we are losing the opportunity to express surrender in all of these simple things.
You know, so many things come to mind. For example, Swami would definitely want all those who consider Swami as their own to be clean shaven. I'm talking about the men. And even among women, he had that the hair should not be disheveled, not with any modern style. Of course, as you say, it might not fit into some societies and all that. But if Swami is most important, I'll do that. You know, when you see people, again, I'm saying in the men's side, it is very evident that Swami wanted white shirt, white pant. You know, that was the dress code. Everybody would wear that. And that was what would happen. However big you might be, you know, whatever big be the VIP, unless you are an external VIP. By external VIP, I mean if you are a minister of the state, you're coming. Right. I mean, you're not a devotee. But even among such people, the recent example we have got, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, who was the Prime Minister of India, who recently passed away. You know, may he rest in peace. But whenever he would come to Swami, he would be in white or maximum cream, you know, a slight off-white, which also the students would wear, you know, cream color or white color, because that is what Swami liked. So today, if you feel that, you know, Swami is physical, if you hold a function in Swami's physical absence, say you are not holding in Prashanthi Nilayam, but somewhere else, and you turn up dressed in blacks or colors, I mean, it's obvious that my preference is stronger than what Swami likes. I may not like white, but Swami likes white, so I'll wear it. I mean, now if I have a meeting, a Satya Sai meeting, wherein I'm dressed in other colors, and you say, what's wrong in it? After all, it's for the spiritual growth. How does it matter? When the body itself doesn't matter, why should the clothes matter? If somebody asks this question, we can directly turn this question and ask it back to them. If the clothes doesn't matter, then why don't you wear just whites? Why do you have to wear fancy colored clothes? Why you have to dress up like this? Because if it's not mattering, if it's truly beyond all this, then wear whites, what Swami said.
You won't ask the question at all then.
You say, why should I not leave long hair? You know, it's how it is. You know, possibly musicians. And there are some legendary musicians who have had a style of hair and who have had a style of dress. Now, possibly I don't become legendary like them in the ability, but in the hair I want to keep like that. No problem in that. But if you feel that you are Swami's musician, don't have a long hair. Because Swami didn't like long hair. Simple as that, you know. And I want to surrender to Swami, but I'm not able to give up my these little likes and preferences. I would like to keep long hair because I'm a musician, and you know, I'm just stating some examples. Why? Because that is my priority over, I mean, Swami didn't like it. Did I have this long hair in Swami's presence? I think that question itself, for those who had the privilege of being in Swami's physical presence, that can be an amazing question that shows my own shallowness. Because in Swami's physical presence, I didn't have long hair. Now that Swami is not there, I mean, all these are things that we can look into in a day-to-day life. And as you said, these are not esoteric things like give up the fruits of action. That statement might be difficult for me to put into practice practically, because I may not actually understand it completely or comprehend its multiple dimensions. But these things, very clear, very simple, it's there for us to follow. I remember after Swami left physically, the trustees held a meeting of all the students who were working in the ashram immediately after that, and they called us all together. And one thing they stated there is, we will be enforcing a strict uniform. Our uniform will 100% be always white and white. And at that point in time, honestly, Prem, I felt, why on earth were they stating this? But today I realize the importance of that, because possibly now people question even, why should I wear white and white? I mean, what's the big thing? I mean, I'll do my work, I'll do it sincerely. And we see that, see those little trespasses or violations happening in and around us, and we realize how important it is. Would I ever do this in Swami's presence? And so, when we are claiming our identity because of Swami, especially when we are claiming our identity, our glory, our whatever influence we have because of Swami, it becomes all the more important that we have to adhere strictly by what He has said, because all that we are is because of what Swami has given us. So the least bit we can do is do what He likes us to do.
Right, and the way Swami is putting it is so beautiful. It's not like, you know, if you don't do this, you don't have a place in heaven. It's not like that. Swami is saying that, why don't you do it with the idea that, you know, this Swami likes. I will do this because this will please Swami. I mean, that attitude, you know, whether it's not for me to judge another person, hey, you will not be able to please Swami. You're not dressed in a manner which will please Swami. It's not for me to judge another person, but Swami is saying that from your own side, if you can, when you're doing something, you say that I am doing this for Swami. In fact, Swami goes on to say, even when you're cleaning your house, you believe that Swami is living in your house. You believe that, you know, when you offer food to Swami, Swami comes and eats. Then you believe that Swami lives, you know, with you. Swami is saying that you clean the house with the idea that it is a fit dwelling for Swami. You maintain the body with clean habits, thinking that it's a fit dwelling for Swami. So these are all simple ways by which the attitude of surrender can be practiced, literally. And that's what Swami is saying in this question.
He further goes on to say, you know, when you're truly surrendering, because Swami says, it is a folly to seek the fruit of action. When one dies, the only items taken with one are one's good and bad deeds. None of the power, the money, the position, the prestige, the vigorous beauty of the body, the culture of the personality, none of these, all these things are gone. And therefore, what folly it is to work for them. And then Swami says, man is life plus desire. Life minus desire is God. And that desire is the mind. When mind disappears, desire disappears. So, Swami clearly states that if you have to be in a state of absolute surrender, the mind should not be there at all. You should have nothing like a desire of your own. I mean, I think it, I'm grateful to Swami for amplifying what we just spoke, because a state of surrender is where I have no desire of my own. You know, Swami would give the example of Lakshmana. When Rama and Lakshmana and Sita are in the forest, Lakshmana asks Rama, should I build a hut? Rama says, yes, build a hut for us to stay. And Lakshmana asks, where should I build it? And Rama says, build it wherever you like. And Swami says that Lakshmana breaks down. He is shedding tears. And Rama asks, brother, what happened? Why are you so sad? Why are you crying? Lakshmana says, brother, why is it that you told me, build a hut where you like? Do I have a like that is separate from you? I felt so distant from you. I felt as if I have done the worst sin. What do you mean by saying, build a hut where you like? Rama, whatever you like is what I like. Please don't put me into such crisis like this. Please tell me where I should build it and I will build it. Swami says, that is the level of surrender Lakshmana was in. It's nothing like a level of surrender. That is surrender. Surrender means not having any likes of your own, because Swami says that's what it is. Man minus desire, that is how you become divine. And that mind is the desire. And when the mind totally disappears, desire disappears. And that is what surrender is. Swami answers Hislop for his question, which is about surrender. It doesn't matter about, you know, surrender being applicable only to spiritual stuff, what we consider like in meditation or japa, dhyana, karma, not like that. Surrender is in everything, in every single act. Every thought that I entertain is not what I like, but a thought that Swami likes. Every word that I speak is not because I like it, but because that is what Swami likes. Every act that I do is not because I like to do it, but because Swami likes it. The moment I lead my life in that manner, that is a life of surrender.
True, and that is the advantage actually this path of devotion actually offers, as Swami would say. That because, you know, everything that you do, there's a purpose and reason for it, right? You know, simple things like if you brush your teeth, you eat your food, if you do a certain, follow a certain exercise regime, everything has a result as a purpose for that act that you're doing. But only when you bring it as, I'm doing this only for Swami, you actually are cutting it off from any future benefit that will come out of that act. You know, you're seeing the perfection of the act itself as an offering. And that's what the surrender offers. That's what Swami was saying. that is there a reason for why you're doing it this way? If there is a reason, then you look at it and say, is the reason being, I mean, is the purpose being met? If it is not being met, then you start getting worried. But if you say that, no, this is what Swami told me to do it, and I'm only worried about doing this perfectly, I'm not worried about whether others will appreciate me or whether, you know, I will get the benefit of doing this. In that way, you actually cut it off completely from the fruits of the action. And that's why Swami says surrender is nothing but doing without any eye on the fruits of the action, purely as this has to be done as an offering to Swami. And then, of course, now Hislop asks some questions which he wants to get settled, or rather some doubts that he wants.
He's just trying to inform. I think, you know, he says, Swami, a taxi will arrive here for us on the afternoon of the 26th for our departure. Right. Because, you know, it became evident that from the previous discussion that Swami would usually grant interviews just before they leave.
Right.
So, possibly this is not the day he's leaving, but in a few days he'll be leaving. So, I think this is his way of informing Swami that, Swami, I'm actually leaving. So, he says, Swami, a taxi will arrive on the 26th. Swami says, no, no, that is wrong. When you came here from so far to see Sai and then take a taxi for Bangalore, Sai is shamed. It should be left for Sai to take care. You should not do it yourselves. And then Hislop says, I will at once cancel the taxi. And then Swami goes on to explain. In the last day or so, there have been riots in Bangalore by students protesting against the campaign by northern politicians to have Hindi as the national language instead of English. There were bomb blasts and other violence. It might be better for you and your wife to leave here on the 25th instead of the 26th, one day earlier. A high northern official will be arriving and probably there will be more rioting. So, this is what Swami says. So, it is not just esoteric, it's also practical. I remember these times when, you know, there was an attempt being made to find a national language for India. And not surprisingly, most of the northern states of India which actually speak Hindi, or some other form of Hindi, or some other language which is similar to Hindi, they had no problems in agreeing for Hindi to be accepted as the national language. Whereas in South India, especially I think in Tamil Nadu,
right,
there was a lot of protest against, because many people didn't know Hindi and they wanted English to be retained. And finally, that's what happened. You know, English was also retained. In the beginning, it was said that till such and such a year, it will be retained. And that went on getting postponed. I think now the thing is English and Hindi are equally acceptable. Along with it, there are also 18 other languages that are accepted as levels of as languages of national importance. So those riots Swami is referring to, and Swami is saying that, so don't leave as per that. When you have come here, you know, leaving to Swami, it makes me ashamed not to plan for you. It's almost like when you have surrendered to Swami, God is shamed when you are being forced to make your plans. So it's almost like when you have surrendered to me, leave it, I'll take care of everything. And that's why Swami is telling them to leave on the 25th.
Right. And Swami is also telling that, you know, ensuring that they leave, they don't get caught in that riots and all of that. But then Hislop asks another interesting question, which is of course related to him leaving for the US, where he says, what is meant when Swami says to a departing devotee that Swami will be with you wherever you are and Swami is in your heart? So that's the question he asks. We'll probably give you the answer which Swami is telling here, but this needs definitely a little more discussion, which probably will spill over to the next week. But we'll read out the answer which Swami is giving anyway. Swami says, the situation can be compared to a man and a stick floating in the ocean. Both have the same motion, up and down with the waves. But the stick does not know what is happening, whereas the man is conscious of the movement. The movement of the stick could be compared to a person in America in whose heart God resides, but who has never been here to visit Swami. The conscious movement of a man swimming in the ocean could be compared to an American who has visited here and then returned home. Now there would be conscious spiritual experience, and that would be the case whether we consciously invited that experience or not. So I think that is the first part of the answer which Swami is giving to that person with that very, very beautiful analogy.
And as you rightly said, Prem, this one requires some kind of in-depth discussion. It's so beautiful. Maybe we will push it to the next satsang. It is a little bit early, but dear listeners, for the sake of good continuity, we will be concluding our satsang here. We are grateful to Swami for this opportunity to go through the conversations that he has gone through. It is indeed an honor. It's a privilege. We are grateful to Swami for the same. As always, dear listeners, if you have any thoughts to share, any feelings, any feedback, anything at all, you can definitely do so by writing to us at listener@radiosai.org. We will try to go through them and try to incorporate as much of the feedback as possible into our next satsang. So, till we meet again next week at the same time, it is Sai Ram from us at the studio here. We will leave you with a song, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.
Hari Om. Muni Pada Janame Sakala Charaja.
ईश्वर सकल चराचर लोकेश्वरेश्वर श्रीकरा भवहरा पांडुरंग पांडुरंग घना घन सुंदरा करुणारत मंदिरा अधि पिलुपो मेलु पुलुपो नी पिलुपो मेलु पुलुपो अति मधुर मधुर मधुरमो गारमो पांडुरंग पांडुरंग घना घन सुंदरा करुणारत मंदिरा पांडुरंग 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 पांडुरंग